Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Last week we talked with Bob Rehm, who's had an outstanding and unique career in ecology, academics, and politics. In this show, we're going to talk about the politics. Many thanks for joining us again, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you talked in the first show about traveling in a train across India and seeing poverty at a scale and depth that changed your perspective of life. Fair?
Yes, that is fair. As a young person, 16-year-old, it was just a real eye-opener for me, and realizing how deeply different things were between myself as an American and the extreme poverty I saw there.
I said, how did it affect you? And you said, compassion.
Compassion, I think, feeling for others, understanding others that are less fortunate than I.
In the last show, we talked about your very unorthodox work at the University of Montana, among other things. You eventually made a decision to get involved in politics. Why?
Good question. I never in my wildest nightmares thought I would be involved in politics, but coming to Montana, I realized how close politics is to the people. I got involved in some environmental issues, particularly the coal strip 3 and 4 power lines that were going right through the Missoula Valley. And through that, I met some legislators. And they were just a common, ordinary people like myself. And having been associated with some of them, Dan Kemis in particular, I realized that, you know, they had the real desire to create change. So I finally ended up one day talking with Dan Kemis and saying, do you think I should run for the legislature? And he jumped on it and said, yeah, you bet.
You can always recognize a gullible man.
That's right. So in 1982, I made my first bid for the legislature and got elected to the House. So I started in 1983 as my first session.
What was, in summary, your career? You started in 83 in the House. How long did you serve? Did you go to the Senate or not?
No, I stayed in the House for 16 years.
Oh, that was before term limits then, obviously.
It was before term limits, yeah.
Okay.
I served 8 sessions. I could have served one more under term limits before it would have gone into effect, but I didn't.
Someone might say, why politics? And I'm hearing you say change. You were dealing with people that were interested in change. That made sense to you. Change of what for what?
Well, let me back up one minute, and that is, you know, the other unique thing about Montana is the legislature meets only every other year for 90 days, and I realized I could still have my job at the university and take winter quarter off, and that pretty well matched the legislative session. So that's what I did for those 8 sessions, is took leave of absence from the university, came over to Helena for the legislative session.
As you say, Montana has a very intimate association with its political people. You see the governor walk down the street, a Supreme Court justice. I mean, it's a very unusual situation. I'd like to ask you about your assessment of the part-time legislature. The good news, some people say, is that you have all kinds of people in the legislature bringing diverse human experience and the wisdom that comes from that. Others say because they're part-time and the problems are very, very complicated in modern society and as in Montana as complicated as any place, they don't have the time to learn the facts, and so they vote their opinions and end up in polarizing politics that we're seeing now. What do you say about it?
Well, I've always said the real advantage of the Montana legislature is it's truly a citizen legislature. The disadvantage of the Montana legislature is that it's a citizen legislature. And there's a big learning curve involved, and some work at it hard to get through that learning curve. And I also think that there were enough people who stayed for a long time, people like Francis Bardineau from up at Harlem, Gene Donaldson, Republican from Helena, others who not only had a depth of knowledge that they could transmit to those of us who were new, but they also exerted an influence, a calming influence, that we've lost with term limits. And I think that was one of the biggest losses, is that they could pull back on the reins when they could see that things were maybe getting out of hand a little bit. And they had worked together, both sides of the aisle, and valued the system for what it was.
I'm hearing you say that experience, maturity, and leadership coming from maturity and experience matter in a body like that.
I think it's very important, yeah. And most people, I would say, took the job seriously and did work hard on that initial learning curve in their specific areas, their specific committees that they served on. I served on natural resources, fish and game, and then Dan Kemmis put me on taxation. I said, what? Taxation?
What a sweet guy he must have been.
He said, well, you're a scientist. You know about numbers. And it ended up, I learned a lot about taxation and eventually became one of the so-called experts on the committee on taxation. That's just an example of a place where it took me 3 or 4 sessions before I was really comfortable with taxation issues. Now you're gone after 4 sessions. And so you lose that continuity, that knowledge that you've gained.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Bob Rehm, the second program in 2 weeks, this time about his political career. You're making clear in your comments that it takes time to learn the rules of the game and how to do it well.
Yes.
How did you find the process? Who did you look to learn from?
Mostly from experienced legislators, and I asked a lot of questions. I would go to the agencies if I had an issue that I was particularly interested in and seek their advice, ask questions about, you know, the history of a particular bill going back. Why do we have this before us, and what's the best approach? So I'd ask a lot of questions.
And your experience in that situation before term limits, of the level of partisanship that we see now, sounds quite different. Am I overstating it?
No, I think it was quite different at that time, and it has changed as a result of term limits. We had at that time a lot of old-timers that had been there for 20, 30, even 40 years in the legislature, and they had a base of knowledge that you could rely on, go talk to them about it, and people on the other side of the aisle as well who were experts in a particular subject. And those old-timers also exerted an influence, a calming influence on the rest of us.
The young upstarts,
yes.
So the people voted in term limits pretty decisively as a way of expressing, I think, dissatisfaction with the status quo. It sounds like you disagree with that decision.
I do, very definitely. And in fact, most, I think, legislators looking back now agree, even people from both sides of the aisle, but it was a very popular thing at that time, not only in Montana, but around the country.
Yeah, I have interviewed people on both sides of the aisle and lobbyists on both sides of issues, and there seems to me to be a consensus among at least the people I've run across that the process of learning that you're talking about doesn't happen as well.
Well, and it has weakened the legislative branch of government, given more strength to the executive branch of government because they can control what's going on with legislators when they don't have those old-timers around with more. Francis Bardineau knew more about the budget of the state than any state employee. And he just was an amazing individual who worked very hard studying the budget.
You went in because you were convinced by Dan Kemmis and others that there was the potential for change. What kind of change were you looking for, and what kind of change did you accomplish?
First of all, first couple sessions realized change happens incrementally. It doesn't happen overnight. In some cases, you're successful in getting something new through, but nearly every piece of legislation is based on a history of things that have gone on before, and so you build on that, like I said, incrementally, and change happens incrementally, not as fast as we would like when we first start in the legislature, but then you realize the process, and you can create change over time.
Okay, let's talk about the process of creating change. You're dealing with human beings. My experience as a facilitator is that if people are emotionally charged up about something, it's hard to get them to sit down and even clearly evaluate their own interests, let alone evaluate where the other person's coming from. Was that your experience, that you had to get people in a certain frame of mind to have a conversation with them, particularly across the aisle?
Yeah, I think that's correct. Again, there is that learning curve, and you can't be expert on all of the areas. So you focus on the committees that you work on, mm-hmm. and that's where your expertise is, and you rely on others for the other committees. So, you know, ask others about issues of the Judiciary Committee or the Health and Human Services Committee. So you depend on each other.
That requires trust.
That requires trust, and you learn who to go to ask those questions. We learn to trust people on the House floor. So if a certain person really knows that subject, I watch their vote, and I would often vote the same as that person because I know they know a lot about that issue and that they're leanings match mine.
Let me just go through some of the bills that you sponsored and let's have a conversation about them. Chief sponsor of the following. You were chief sponsor of the Montana Superfund Law, the Montana Stream Access Law, Best Forest Practices in Streamside Management Zones, adding white sturgeon to the state endangered species list, controlling importation, introduction, and transplantation of wildlife, civil and criminal penalties for hazardous waste violation, restitution payment for the illegal killing of wildlife, encouraging water development projects that improved efficiency, resolution urging National Park Service to manage elk and bison in National Park. This is a long list. Allow regulation of archery equipment by the Fish and Game Commission, incentives for low-emission wood or biomass combustion devices, revising the law on identification, transportation, and inspection of game-farmed animals, and general revisions of game-farm laws. Now, that's quite a list. What stands out to you?
Well, my very first session, there was a lot of discussion going on about stream access. And I actually served on an interim committee between 83 and 85 to try to come up with laws that provide for stream access.
When we say stream access, we're talking about the public's right to get to the water.
The public's right to get to the water.
Okay.
So partway through that interim, in fact, that fall before the next session, the Supreme Court came down with their decision on the Dearborn River and the Beaverhead River, both cases that were before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that the waters belong to the people and the people have the right to access those waters. And so that kind of changed things, and it was interesting to see that some conservation groups and agricultural groups saw that they needed to get together. And
they had not been together before. They'd been on opposite sides pretty much?
Kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they agreed on parts of it, but other parts they were...
Sure.
So apart from our committee, which had already come up with a couple of bills that didn't really address the whole issue, these groups worked together, and just before the next session started, they came up with a compromise. And interestingly enough, several of them came to me and asked me if I would be the chief sponsor. That would have been the 85 session.
Modesty aside, why did they do that?
I think they knew that I had been on that interim committee. So they had worked with the interim committee. And looking at the interim committee, there were a few people probably that had worked harder than others on this issue. And I had tried to be, you know, fair to people on both sides of the issue. And I suspect maybe that's why they came and asked me to do it.
My sense with this type of work is that there's something else involved, and that's the style of communication. And just in these interviews, it seems to me you exhibit a style of communication that conveys reasonableness, patience, and that you can listen to another point of view without getting hot-headed about it. Is that fair?
I think it's fair for most of the time. Occasionally I could be a hothead. It turned out the 1985 session, we had a 50-50 tie in the House, 50 Republicans, 50 Democrats. So when they asked if I would carry the bill, the first person I went to ask to co-sign it was Bob Marks. He had been on the interim committee with me, but he also was the Republican leader, not majority, but a Republican floor leader for the 1985 session. So I went to him and asked if he would co-sponsor it with me, and we had some discussion about it, and he agreed. And then I said to him, you know what, I'd like to just put your name and my name on it and not run around trying to grab a bunch of other legislators and keep it simple, keep it real simple, so that we aren't weighing the number of Democrats, the number of Republicans who signed on to the bill. And he agreed to that also, and that's how we went forward with it. It was very interesting bill, and it succeeded, and certainly was some controversy. Some minor amendments went on it, but I certainly have to give that group that worked to put it together beforehand a lot of credit for coming up with the work they did.
And it stood the test of time.
It stood the test of time for 30 years now, 31 years.
And an issue of intense emotion and philosophical disagreement.
Yeah, there have been. And,
yeah, I mean,
and
going in.
Attempts at trying to kill it or change it. There were some additions for bridge access more recently that helped clarify some issues. But other than that, it stood the test of time.
Other bills that I read that you were the chief sponsor of that were particularly satisfying in any way to you?
Some of the wildlife bills, particularly restitution payment for illegal killed wildlife. What that means is that up until then, people had to pay a fine, and it was up to local judges how much that fine would be. But there was no payment back to the state, to the people of the state, for the value of that animal that was lost. So what restitution payment is, it's on top of any fines. So, for example, if you kill a mature bull elk, the restitution payment, I think, is about $1,000 that you must pay for that value. So we establish values for everything from fish to mature bull elk, and those numbers have changed some over the years, but it brings in over $200,000 a year now, which is pretty amazing.
It is amazing, and it's amazing to me that just in terms of the amount of illegal killing that's going on.
Yeah, unfortunately. But it has, I think, also helped dampen it, because rather than just a slap on the hand by a local judge, you are also paying, you know, a substantial restitution payment back to the people of the state. The other area I got very interested in was game farms, and I particularly worked with somebody from Fish Wildlife Parks who was an undercover agent and told me about all the crap going on with game farms. And so I took on that issue, and First of all, just requiring that all game farm animals be marked in some way with ear tags or tattoos, and that any time they're going to be transported, you had to get a certificate for transporting them.
Why? What was the problem?
The problem was there were some that were shooting preserves, but most of them were just raising elk, because at that time you could sell a breeding cow for up to $10,000. And so there was a substantial financial incentive for running these game farms. They would sell them to other states.
But somebody might say, what's the problem? You used the word all the crap going on. Something had to be going on other than just selling animals.
Yeah, the game farms are a great place for transmission of diseases. They are also, people were trying to breed bigger and better elk, which is contrary to my way of thinking and the idea of fair chase hunting. And there were other illegal activities that I learned about, that some game farms were just a front for operations, you know, selling drugs and other things going on.
So you continued with the legislation?
I did. I got a bill passed. It was watered down some. I went at it the second time. And then, by then, the public, the sportsman public, I will say, had learned enough about the issue that they put forward a petition just simply closing down game farms in Montana, as had already been done in Wyoming, by the way. And that petition succeeded. So we ended game farms in Montana by citizen initiative.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Bob Rehm, the second program in 2 weeks, this time about his political career. Your resume includes that you were chairman of the Democratic Party of Montana from 1997 to 2005. That's a fair piece of time. A delegate, a Democratic National Committee person as well. Why are you a Democrat?
I'm a Democrat because it most closely followed my values. You know, I grew up in mostly a Republican family, in the old-style Republicans. When I ended in the legislature, we were down to very low numbers as Democrats. I think we had 33 in the House and 16 in the Senate, not even enough to block two-thirds of votes in some cases. So I decided to run for chair of the state Democratic Party after I retired from the university and the legislature. And I served as chair the next 8 years, full-time, no pay. And
I said you were a gullible guy earlier. I didn't know that gullible.
Not very smart. I didn't learn very much along the way. But it was very rewarding. We managed over those next four elections to get back up to an actual majority in the Senate when John Tester was president of the state Senate. And we had a 50-50 split in the House again in 2005. So I felt I was successful that way in bringing strength back to the party.
What was the process like compared to being in the legislature? The politics, the internal politics, the politics party to party, the actual work?
The actual work that I took on was I decided we really had to go back to the basic county central committees and strengthen them. So I traveled all over the state. I went to Plentywood and Glendive and Miles City, and we embarked on a program of really trying to strengthen local central committees and giving them some of the tools they needed to help form those central committees, but also in the process developing potential for new legislators.
Candidates
for the legislature. If they worked with the local central committee and developed an interest, and they were certainly encouraged then to run for the legislature.
How much did your work depend, the success of revitalizing the center, the committees, depend upon getting people fired up about political philosophy. In other words, Democrats represent X, Republicans represent Y. That sort of enthusiasm for one or the other often, I think, generates interest. How do you get local people energized?
It isn't an easy job, and it worked in some areas and didn't work in other areas. But I think making people realize their democratic values deep down, like the High Line used to be all Democrats, and there were still very many of those old-time Democrats who felt very strongly, but getting those old-timers involved with some of the younger people helped generate interest.
You served on the National Committee. What was that like?
I did, and it was really interesting to see how other states operated, and I really pushed with the DNC to get more recognition for rural states like Montana. Montana is a place that presidential campaigns would fly over to get from the West Coast to the East Coast,
right,
and rarely make a stop here. So I fought to get at least some representation during those presidential elections of people coming to Montana.
And they do. They just were here.
they have been, yes. Howard Dean came in and adopted a 50-state strategy, which I strongly supported. He provided support to us. He provided a couple of staff members. He raised money to do that rather than just building buildings in Washington, D.C. for the DNC. He put it out on the ground, and I admire him for that.
I'd like to combine the 16-year-old kid on the train in India and the man approaching 80 with the tremendous political experience you've had. You combine the two and you boil it down. What's most important for the future of our country, and how did you come to that viewpoint?
During the time I was in the legislature, I saw things become more and more polarized, and it's gotten even worse since then, and that's been kind of discouraging. You know, I really feel strongly that and I developed more and more of an appreciation, I guess, for the human condition, not less about environmental issues, but I realized that we really needed to address issues of equality, of economic justice, and rights for all, gay rights. I carried the first bill adding sexual orientation to all the human rights issues. I never succeeded in three times I tried, but that's an example, I guess, of my turning towards those human issues.
Bob Rehm, I very much regret to say we're out of time for the second show, and I thank you again for taking the time to join us on Home Ground. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.